let's rejoin our conversation with Michael Hiblin as he talks about the history of the Rock Island Railroad in Arkansas.
We're now two trains running. Hey, now one, how going my way.
Let's move to your conversations with engineers and conductors about some of the wrecks, although that's awful to think about. Can you tell us about what you learned from some of the folks you talked to about these?
There are a lot of horrific accidents. It's a dangerous profession. It's safer today, and the railroad companies have always pushed safety, and it has gotten safer over the years. The installation of block signals reduced the number of accidents.
There was one former employee I talked with, his name was Guy Winters, who told an incredibly moving story about a near miss where a mistake he made almost caused what could have been a horrific accident with a passenger train. He opened up, starting to tell the story by expressing hesitation whether he should even tell me it on tape.
I don't know if I should tell this or not. I shook for half a day thinking how bad it was. But I had some good engineers that trained me and taught me, gave me good advice what I was doing wrong with the brakes. And I was pretty green, but after I was promoted, I drew train number 38. That was the hottest thing ever. Rock Island had running out of here westward. I got a hold of it, and I must have had about 25 cars. That's how hot it was. Well, I topped a hill right east of Ola, Arkansas, and I hit two torpedoes. Well, while I was sitting at Biddle in Little Rock, I saw the passenger train run. It went by me. I hit the two torpedoes, I reached over and got the automatic air, and I set some air on about 38 cars. And what I did wrong, I started down the hill into Ola. And I was doing 55 miles an hour. I reached over and I flushed my brakes down, my locomotive brakes. That meant only brakes I had was on 38 cars, and my locomotives outweighed my cars. And what I did was turn those locomotives floating free with tonnage going down a hill, and those cars were trying to retard it. And the time I hit the curve at the bottom, I looked up at my speedometer. It was still about 40 miles an hour. I put it in emergency, and I went around that curve, and I thought, if there's a red wigwag sitting there at the depot, I'm going to run through him. I'm going through that passenger train. There wasn't nothing I could do. I looked at that depot and the train was gone. I imagine I went an eighth of a mile the other side of the depot. It's still in emergency. I got down on the ground and I shook and I shook. And the brakeman got down and he says, "Guy, what in the world were you thinking about?" I said, I wasn't. He said, "Do you know if that passenger train's still been sitting there in the Ola depot, you'd have went right through the middle of it?" I said, women and children. Women and children, I'd have killed every one of them. They said, "Well, come on." I said, "No, I'll get back up on that locomotive in a minute. I can't right now." I almost cried. It bad a mistake it's making to that.
We're now just two trains running. Hey, now one, how going my way.
What really impacted the Rock Island was a proposed merger with Union Pacific that was presented in 1964. It was a time when railroads were growing. The Union Pacific wanted to expand greatly, and they wanted to buy the Rock Island. The Southern Division that included Arkansas was going to go to Southern Pacific. So when you had a larger company that was going to buy you, it was a rough era already economically for railroads. But with the idea that this bigger company was going to take over, the Rock Island stopped doing maintenance on track. They started deferring maintenance. The engines weren't being maintained very well. And everything about the Rock Island began to go down. That started a good decade of just complete deferred maintenance. And it started what's said to have been the most complicated case to ever go before the Interstate Commerce Commission. This merger case stretched on for about a decade. They took a whole lot of testimony. There was opposition from competing railroads.
And historian Bill Pollard was really able to explain the intricacies of this proposed merger to me.
During the undercurrent of all of that, during this whole thing, was the Union Pacific merger. And most of the Rock Island management thought that ultimately the Rock Island was going to be a merger partner, probably with Union Pacific, and the part in Arkansas was going to be sold to Southern Pacific. But in any event, there was going to be some white knight riding in to save the day. You've got to envision the situation. Everybody was trying to make do with nothing. There was not enough money for much of anything, and corners were cut, and track maintenance declined. It's hard to do maintenance if you just don't have them, not generating enough money. So probably some bad decisions were made by management, but in any event, the railroad physical plant went down pretty bad.
And by the time this was eventually approved, in about 1975, the Rock Island was in such bad shape that the Union Pacific said, we don't want it anymore. It would take too much money to upgrade the infrastructure. And at this point, that left the Rock Island hanging in the wind.
Says as she flies away.
And particularly in the late 70s, it really declined. But the merger fell through. By the time the ICC agreed to it, I think this is common knowledge, the UP had decided, no, we don't want it. And the Rock Island was just basically left hanging in the wind.
They tried to rebrand.
That was part of their bankruptcy filing. They filed for bankruptcy protection. They sought federal assistance. And it was at this time that the Rock Island employees tried to help the railroad. It was considered a loan, but many Arkansas employees took a 10% pay cut, wanting to help the railroad. And the railroad was rebranded. It was felt that the name the Rock Island was outdated, and they started calling everything the Rock.
One of the more questionable decisions, perhaps, of Rock Island management at that time was that the railroad needed a new image, and that the term Rock Island and the old Rock Island Herald were somewhat archaic and a little bit dated, and that one of the salvations would be to go on a big PR blitz and rebrand the railroad as the Rock.
And no offense to the Rock, but the rebranding wasn't the prettiest I've ever seen. They painted the trains blue and white.
And in a dirty rail environment, white is not a very good color for locomotives. So they almost immediately looked really grimy.
They rebrand. They're not doing well. The final nail in the coffin was a strike by the Brotherhood of Railway and Airline Clerks in August 1979. Employees had by that time been working on expired labor contracts, and a dispute over past due wages finally brought the matter to a head.
The final thing that really prompted the end of the Rock Island was a 1979 strike. There was a union leader, a national leader, who had just lost a major battle with the Norfolk and Western Railroad. So he really fired up the union and said, we need to get the back wages that you're owed. This is from the 10%
that they had tried to
give the railroad, which was a loan. You also had employees who weren't getting pay raises. The employees knew the dire condition of the railroad at this point, but you also can't cross a picket line because then you're a scab. And this led to management attempting to run the trains. It also ended up with this consortium of railroads called the Kansas City Terminal that was made up of railroads that operated in Kansas City, taking over control of the Rock Island. So you didn't have people who really had the best interests of the Rock Island running the railroad. You had creditors who were continuing to argue that the railroad should be shut down.
We had good business, had real good business, and then when they started to negotiate a new contract, well, the guy that owned the controlling interest, that old man Crown, why he got to want to do away with it, and he wouldn't let them negotiate with the union.
There was a court ruling in January when the Rock Island management was still trying to present plans for reorganizing the railroad. And Frank McGar, who was the federal judge overseeing that, made the determination that the reorganization plan was never going to work. They had made a fairly good faith effort during the reorganization to try to keep things going. But one of the big bondholders, Henry Crown, I think was his name, mm-hmm. was...
LT called him Old Man Crown.
Yeah, well, that was probably one of the more polite things he's been called. He was truly hated by most of the people on the Rock Island. He was determined to see the railroad liquidated and had for a number of years argued that he was part of this fantasy that there's too much railroad mileage in this country and the Rock Island is redundant and all this foolishness of the Rock Island goes where everybody else goes, but it takes longer to get there. That's foolish simplification.
And he repeatedly called for it to be shut down.
Frank McGar eventually agreed that there was no other course, and in January they basically told the Rock Island management to go forth with plan the shutdown, and at that point they started issuing embargo orders in February and starting moving all the cars to the big yards like El Reno and everything with the idea of shutting down by the end of March.
And in March 1980, that's when you really saw the end of the Rock Island. Couple of dates, March 23rd, you had one part of the trackage that was handed off to the Cotton Belt to run, and they only ended up running it and serving clients for 90 days. And then about a week later, the rest of it ended.
And I bet you wanna tell her something that she don't know. Yeah, I bet you wanna take her somewhere she ain't never been before. Sounds like wishful thinking.
And Bill Pollard, the railroad historian I spoke with, he was going out in these final days to photograph and to capture what was happening there. And he was just trying to find out. It was a very fluid situation, when the last trains would be running. And he ended up photographing those final days. And you see his pictures in the book.
I was taking pictures, and you could tell that things were just going down. There were fewer and fewer cars in the yard. The trains were shorter. And on one afternoon, I learned that this last train I think there were 6 locomotives and about 15 cabooses and a few other cars were going to go west. And so my brother and I went down to catch them initially at HH Crossing, which is the crossing where the Rock Island crossed the Mopac, just south of Union Station. And it was rainy and terrible day, and here comes a couple of Cotton Belt Jeeps on the front, and I thought, well, this is just, at that point, the Cotton Belt had taken over going out as far as Perry, so they were running a Perry turn. I thought, well, this is just the Perry turn, and we'll take a few pictures, and the Rock Island will be behind it. Well, the 2 Cotton Belt locomotives passed, and then we could see all these Rock Island locomotives, and it was the final train that Cotton Belt was dragging out to Perry, and actually a Rock Island crew was being transported by a taxi cab from Boonville to Perry to pick up this train and take it on west. And this was late afternoon. It was about 3 or 4 by the time it crossed there, and we took pictures of it there and took pictures of it at, I think, out by the Lock and Dam, and went on to Perry to catch it there, and it was dark by that time, so we saw it go by there and stop for a little while, but we didn't actually get any pictures of that, and that was the last train west.
And the rails, after sitting abandoned for a few years, were eventually taken up and actually sold for scrap. The steel of the rails actually sold for scrap.
This is the saddest story in the world, Michael. What's the hope in terms of capturing those imaginations of kids in second grade looking out the window waiting for the train?
I guess my key goal was just to help preserve the memory of what was the Rock Island. And in particular, visitors to the Clinton Presidential Library, that they know what that once was. And I was hoping, too, that I could come up with some rare images, some new images that maybe they hadn't seen before, that we can have a few new photos and at least keep the memory of the Rock Island alive.
I don't want no aggravation when my train has left the station. If you're there or not, I may not even know. Tell the gossipers and liars I will meet them in the fire. Let the train blow the whistle when I go.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, the Damsels in Distress, Jim Mize, the Crumbs, the Mallet Brothers, David Ramirez, Fret and Worry, Willie Carlisle, Guitar Dave Fredju, Detroit Johnny, Amy Jo Savannah, and Bonnie Montgomery. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to reporter, photographer, and writer Michael Hiblin, whose book, Through Photographs and Captions, chronicles and captures the history of the Rock Island Railroad. Listen to Michael Hiblin's podcasts on HiblinRadio.com for the full story of the Rock Island Railroad in Arkansas. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Johnny Cash.
But you're gonna miss me when I'm gone.